of Abasai P. Counsel, thank you very much. You are excused in the court. We'll go on to the next case of the day, which is Christensen versus Broken Bow Indians, which is public schools. And Justice Frydenberg is recused from this matter. So the court will be joined by District Court Judge Stratton. Counsel, you may be seated. And Judge Stratton, welcome to the court.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. Mr. Duncan, good morning to you. Are you splitting your time with Mr. Harbaugh?
No, I will be
using it all.
Okay.
Maybe.
Very good. And also we have Mr. Krejci and Mr. Ryler, is that correct? And you are splitting your time.
Yes, sir.
I knew somebody.
Matthew Ryler, I'm on behalf of Broken Bow Public School.
Okay.
I think I have a 10-minute portion.
It was my intent that Mr. Riley would use his full 10 minutes first, and then I would have 2 minutes. Yeah.
Okay, and you also have 12 minutes.
Yes, that's my understanding. Yes.
I think we've got it straight. Do any counsel have any other questions?
No, Your Honor.
Very good. Then, Mr. Duncan, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, James Duncan on behalf of the plaintiff appellants Michael and Kathy Christensen, both personally and as next friends and co-guardian and conservators of their son, Chad Christensen. This is a political subdivisions torts claims act brought by the Christensens against Broken Bow High School for injuries that Chad Christensen received as a result of a motor vehicle accident that occurred on June 1st of 2012 in Custer County. We are requesting that the court find that Nebraska Revised Statute 60-6273, which is commonly known as the Nebraska seatbelt defense, does not apply in this case. We are also requesting that the court find that Nebraska Revised Statute 60-6267 is not as narrowly construed as the district court found. Because this raises a question of statutory interpretation, it's a question of law, and we believe that the court's standard of review is to conduct an independent analysis and reach a conclusion independent of the findings of the district court. Because the status of this case is post-motion for directed verdict, we would also suggest that all controverted facts are to be construed in favor of the plaintiff appellants. On June 1st of 2012, Chad Christensen was a minor. He was 17 years old and he was between his junior and senior years in high school. He was also a member of the varsity boys basketball team for Broken Bow High School. And on that day, Chad and seven of his teammates were on a return trip from a Kearney Catholic High School boys team camp. And as they were traveling home in a Ford 10-passenger van owned by Broken Bow Public Schools and used for purposes of an activities van that was driven by assistant basketball coach Zane Harvey, who was also a teacher for Broken Bow High School. And sitting in the front seat, also accompanying the team, was the head basketball coach Anthony Bloom, who was also a teacher for Broken Bow High School. Chad Christensen was, there was three bench seats in this van. Other than the front seats. Chad was seated in the middle seat, and he was seated in the center of that seat. Neither Chad nor any of the other students in the van were wearing the available seat belts that were in the van. As they were returning home, and they had just passed through Ansley, Nebraska, a Chevy half-ton pickup driven by Albert Sherbeck crossed the center line and collided head-on with the van, squarely in the lane of travel of the van. Neither Chad nor any of the other students were using their seat belts at the time of the collision. Both Coach Harvey and Coach Bloom were killed, and so was Mr. Sherbeck. Chad's most significant injury as a result of this accident was a severe traumatic brain injury. Broken Bow Public Schools has maintained throughout this litigation that the school is not liable for the coaches failing to ensure that Chad was using a seatbelt under the theory that the Nebraska seatbelt defense in 60-2 or 6273 applies to make evidence of the non-use of a seatbelt inadmissible for purposes of proving liability or proximate cause, and that based on that, the plaintiffs are not able to prove their case.
What have we said about, are you calling it 273?
Yes, the seatbelt defense.
Right, the non-use, right, is
correct,
not admissible regarding liability or proximate cause, but
yes,
is admissible on mitigation of damages.
Correct.
What have we said in the cases that that means?
This issue has never been addressed. We believe that this is a case of first impression as it applies to minors.
As it applies to minors?
Yes.
But
too.
Have we not said was it Warner, that it only applies to mitigation?
I believe so, when
and
it applies
elsewhere.
To a driver. I think that there's some analogies to be made of how does it apply when it's another driver that has not caused this accident, if it was Coach Harvey in this instance, of whether or not, if he was unbuckled, whether or not Mr. Sherbeck could have made a claim for use of the seatbelt defense against Mr. Harvey if he was not wearing that seatbelt. So yes, we've applied it as to drivers. We do not find any Nebraska case, any Nebraska statutes, and actually don't even find anything in other states with similar statutes that have applied a seatbelt defense to an injured, unbelted minor non-front seat
So
passenger.
You think that makes it different than the cases where we've said it only applies to mitigation of damages?
I believe that supports
then
the
theory.
Then
how do you integrate, if I may, 269, says it, the non-use shall not constitute prima facie evidence of negligence. That's not restricted to drivers or oncoming cars and so forth. That's in 6269. I'm trying to read these all together.
Yes, and that is exactly, I think, our main point is that the statutory scheme, which is titled Occupant Protection Systems, which is nine statutes from 60-6265 through 60-273, there's nine separate statutes. They break down into three parts. And so what you're referring to, Your Honor, with 269 is part of part two that we believe. And it only refers to a driver failing to ensure that a minor passenger is not using a seatbelt. And so that is a separate provision from 6273, the seatbelt defense, which we believe only applies to persons who are referred to in 60-6270, which places the burden upon the driver not to operate a motor vehicle unless the driver and all front seat passengers are buckled. But that provision wouldn't necessarily apply to a minor because 6267 already requires the driver to have a minor front seat passenger buckled. So 626.
It kind of drops off, though. It just says ensure it's done from 8 to 18.
Yes.
Figure out the legal significance of it. Well, that's why we're here.
That's exactly
okay.
Right. That's exactly right. And the reason for being here, we believe, is very important. It's not just that it applies, whether it applies to Chad Christensen, it applies to every minor passenger that's not seated in the front seat of a vehicle in the state of Nebraska. And if it applies the way that Broken Bow Schools proposes, and the way that the district court has found, we find it hard to envision how a minor child that is injured when they are a backseat passenger, that a driver has not ensured that they're using a seatbelt, we find it hard to envision how a child would ever have any recourse against the driver that's failed to protect them.
Hasn't the legislature said they don't have any recourse?
We don't believe so, no. What we believe is that the language in 60-6269, where it states that it shall not be prima facie evidence, is not barring any of that. And certainly we disagree with the district court's finding that 6273, the seatbelt defense, applies to barring plaintiff's evidence. We submit that it only applies to barring defense evidence for certain purposes. And so when the legislature provides in 6269 that it shall not constitute prima facie evidence, what it's really saying is the violation of the statute alone does not prove the negligence, which is common of what we have with most of our other statutes in the state of Nebraska, which is if I run a stop sign, it doesn't mean that I'm automatically negligent. You have to prove that that's a breach if I run a stop sign. But you also have to prove that it was a proximate cause of some injury to a plaintiff, and that those injuries resulted in some type of damage. And so those are the elements that still have to be proven of the negligence.
So and that's, we have some statutory ambiguity here. Can we look at statutory history, legislative history?
The legislative history, and I won't represent that we've read every single word, but we weren't able to find a lot of guidance in the current scheme of what the intent of this is, because when it was first introduced and then all through all the debate, it became something else. Because what we can find is in 1984, it was originally going to be evidence of seatbelt use is inadmissible in any civil case, period. Many states have maintained that type of a language, but through the debate process in the legislature, and we haven't been able to find all those what happened. It's kind of the making sausage thing of what you get in the end and
so
you don't know.
What you're telling us is we don't know.
We don't know. For some reason, the legislature from when it was first
assumed they knew.
Well, we have to assume that. That's the way that the interpretation reads. But under State versus Alberinga, the approach that this court has taken is that the intent is to be deduced from the whole of the scheme, which is 265 through 273, and not pull out a particular statute and read that in isolation. And that's what we suggest that both the school has suggested to the district court, and what the district court has done is specifically focus on 6273 and make it apply to everything. And so what we suggest is that 6269 applies to minors. 6273, the reason we believe that our explanation applies is because until the enactment of 6273, mitigation was purely an after-the-fact defense. It only becomes a defense in seatbelt issues because of this statute. And it makes sense to say that a defendant cannot present evidence of non-use to disprove liability or proximate cause that his actions have resulted in, because it only comes into play after the driver has been determined to be negligent. So what makes sense of what it doesn't say is it doesn't prevent evidence of duty or damages, which is where the mitigation comes from. If I'm the negligent driver, I've been found negligent, I can address duty. My victim has a duty to wear their seatbelt under 6267 or 6270. Not under 6267, because a child does not have a duty to wear a seatbelt. The duty is on the driver. So the child can't breach that duty. That's why 6273 would never apply to a child to prevent that evidence.
And unless the child is the driver.
Then it does. Then that's my argument. A non-driving, non-front seat minor who is unbelted has a cause of action because there's no duty on that child to be wearing a seatbelt.
Do we have to read a lot into the statute to get there?
I don't believe so. When it came to me, and not because I finally was able to make it up, when I took a copy of 6265 and 6266, we define occupational or occupant protection and we require it be installed. That's the first two. Then if you read 6267, 68, and 69 together, 69 refers to 67, and 68, the penalty provision, it applies to 67. There's a separate penalty provision for 6272, referring back to 6270. If they were to be all together, there'd be no reason for two penalty provisions within the statute. And so then if you read 6270, 71, 72, and 73, those all flow together because they all use the word wear, W-E-A-R. In 6267 and 6269, they use the word use, U-S-E, which we believe is also a clue from the legislature. There's using within 6267 requiring the use with children. And 6270, where you're required to wear. That's the duty on the driver or possibly front seat passenger. That's not a minor. If there are any other questions, I believe I've used my time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Riley, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Justice.
And before I begin, I've noticed I have 12 minutes up on this counter. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly going to leave my 2 minutes and just use my 10.
That's up to you.
Well, I don't have the 12 minutes, and I don't want to deprive counsel here. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matthew Riley. I am the attorney for Broken Bow Public Schools, which is the defendant in Appalee in this case. As Mr. Duncan alluded to, we are up on this court, or before this court, on a directed verdict. This is actually the second directed verdict that the district court granted in favor of the Broken Bow Public Schools. This verdict, this directed verdict in favor of the schools, is the correct result. It is the result that the school district has been requesting, I think, since 2014 when this case first was brought. The court correctly applied the plain, unambiguous language of Nebraska's seatbelt laws to the undisputed material facts in this case and correctly found that the lone evidence of negligence that the plaintiffs have attempted to offer here is not sufficient to prove a cause of action under the state law, and it's not admissible to prove either liability or proximate cause under the state law. At the conclusion of my argument, I will request that this court affirm the lower court's grant of a directed verdict in favor of the school district and hold that the directed verdict was proper under the law. This accident, as Mr. Duncan alluded to, occurred on June 1st, 2012. Mr. Christensen was one of seven passengers. Mr. Christensen himself, a 17-year-old licensed driver aware of the rules of the road, was an unbelted passenger in the back of the van. There are three material facts that I see as kind of the dispositive facts of this case. The first is that when this accident occurred, Mr. Sherbeck crossed the center line directly head-on with the school van. The second fact is that, as the plaintiffs put on and their very first witness in this case, Mr. Harvey, the operator of that van, had absolutely no way of avoiding the collision, had no contributory cause whatsoever to the actual occurrence of the collision. And the third fact is that Mr. Christensen was unbelted. In fact, the plaintiff's only evidence, as they admitted at the close of the evidence in an argument on the directed verdict, their only evidence of negligence is that Mr. Christensen was unbelted. This case presents a very basic matter, calls on one of the most fundamental concepts we have as statutory construction, is to simply interpret the rules of the statute. Altogether, not to include additional words, as you, Justice Papik, alluded to, a lot of these words have to do a lot of work, and we have to add a lot of words to the statute to have it read the way plaintiffs would have this court rule. There are three statutes that apply here. I want to avoid the tripping up with all the different numbers of 60-dash and all that, so I have three different names for them, I suppose. We have the first statute, which is 60-6,267. I'll refer to that as the duty. That provides that a driver has the duty to ensure that all occupants under the age of 18 are properly belted, are using what the statute refers to as an occupant protection system. The second statute that we concern ourselves with here is the enforcement statute. The enforcement statute is two sections later in 60-6,269. That statute provides that a violation of the duty statute, quote, shall not constitute prima facie evidence of negligence. Now, counsel alluded to or suggested that that doesn't rule out using it to prove or using it as evidence of causation or using it as evidence of damage or what have you. But this is clear as day, and it says prima facie evidence of negligence, proximate cause, duty, breach, all of those are subsumed within the definition of negligence. And prima facie evidence under the Black's Law Dictionary is defined as evidence that by itself is sufficient to sustain a judgment. As the plaintiffs have already admitted, this is the evidence that must stand by itself in this case. And according to the statutory definition, that by itself is insufficient to sustain a judgment against the school district. The third rule is more of a rule of evidence. The third rule provides that Evidence that a person was or was not wearing his or her seatbelt at the time of injury is, quote, not admissible or shall not be admissible in regard to the issue or, in regard to the issue of liability or proximate cause. Again, if this evidence, even if it could stand by itself, under section 60-6,273, that is not admissible to prove liability or proximate cause. And I believe there's a question earlier to counsel about how this kind of plays with the Warner case. And the play, or the counsel repeatedly refers to this as the, quote, seatbelt defense. It's not a seatbelt defense. Those words appear nowhere in the statutes. These are seatbelt laws. And we
can't. And in Warner, with respect to 273, we said non-use is admissible only regarding mitigation of damages. You got to get to working on damages before you can refer to non-use under that interpretation. Is that correct?
Under 273, under this evidentiary rule, there are two sentences in the entire statute. And the first is, it's not admissible to prove liability or in regard to liability or proximate cause. And the second sentence says, however, it is admissible for mitigation of damages up to the 5% cap. That however, or that exception to the rule, cannot consume the rule. And that exception makes sense when you consider that the case of, I think it's Vredeveld, if I'm saying that correctly, but in Vredeveld, this court considered the mitigation of damages. And the defense there attempted to argue that simply the plaintiff not having his seatbelt on at the time of the injury meant that they're automatically entitled to the mitigation defense. And this court held, well, no, you still need to prove proximate cause. And so it makes sense when we have a complete comprehensive ban on this evidence being admissible for liability or proximate cause, but we have an exception that says you can get a 5% mitigation of damages as a defendant if you prove the proximate causal connection between the lack of a seatbelt and the injury.
Is the wording of that statute a little bit curious in the sense that proximate cause is an element of liability, isn't it?
No, I think it's, well, I guess I would consider it more of a belt and suspenders, Your Honor. I think that it's saying that it cannot be admissible. If you think of the four elements of negligence, I would consider the liability to be more of the duty and the breach elements. And proximate cause to come as the third, obviously, before damages.
Well, and I'm with Judge Castle.
Okay.
There's a little curiosity. I'm not sure what that means.
Well, I
assume
think,
for the moment that we would typically say that the formulation of negligence, duty, breach of duty, proximate cause, are the elements of liability. What difference, if any, does that make in interpreting this statute?
I don't think it makes, with all due respect, I don't think it makes any difference. I think that section 273 also needs to be read in with the entire statute, including 269. And 269 has already said, we're talking about the duty of a driver to have rear minor passengers belted, that duty or a breach of that duty or a violation of that duty is not prima facie evidence of negligence. And so I suppose under a different kind of case where there are multiple examples of negligence, where you have maybe erratic driving or some other contributory cause to the accident where the plaintiff has here, where a plaintiff has not admitted that the driver had absolutely no contribution to the accident, that we might be talking about a situation where they're using it for a different purpose. But here, they have no other evidence. There is absolutely nothing in the record suggests that the driver did anything wrong except for the alleged violation of this duty statute in the seatbelt laws. And that takes us to the crux of all of this. And I think to get back to Chief Justice, you had a question about the legislative history or the legislative intent. And I will echo Mr. Duncan in that there's not a whole lot there. But I think what the legislative intent, there's not even an ambiguity in the statute that gets us there. But if there was, legislative intent makes it clear, both on the face of these statutes and in the history of the legislation, that this was all done as an effort to create, I guess, as much of a minimum impact of a violation of the seatbelt laws. This was done to, right, from the legislative history, to comply with federal regulations and to secure highway funding. They made it a secondary offense in the statutes. They said it's not punishable or it's not citable even by the police unless you've done something else wrong on the road. And even then, as a secondary offense, the maximum penalty, no matter if you have 8 passengers back in the back seat that aren't belted or 1, it's a $25 fine and nothing more. It's a quantum leap to go from that minimizing effect of a seatbelt violation by the legislature to now say that you have a maximum liability under the Tort Claims Act. And I want to reserve the 2 minutes for Mr. Krejci. And if there are no other questions, in conclusion, I'd ask on behalf of the Broken Bow School District that this case be affirmed and that the directed verdict be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Krejci, good morning to you.
Good morning. Jared Krejci on behalf of Beverly Sherbeck. She is the personal representative for her late husband. May it please the court counsel. I just wanted to reserve this 2 minutes predominantly to ask if there are any questions about my cross appeal. I concur wholeheartedly with Mr. Riley, and I think he's probably more prepared to talk about the actual seatbelt statutes than I was. But since I filed this cross appeal, and really, since I do believe in Mr. Riley's argument, maybe it was unnecessary to file the cross appeal, but it's incredibly important to Mrs. Sherbeck that there's finality for her after she obtained a defense verdict that was upheld on appeal. And the alternative of if the district court's motion for directed verdict is reversed, then Mrs. Sherbeck, as personal representative, faces involvement in this ongoing case as a third-party defendant brought into the case by Broken Bow Public School. So,
if the case is reversed.
If the case is reversed, then the procedural posture will be the Christensens versus Broken Bow Public Schools with Beverly Sherbeck as a third-party defendant. And that would be in the absence of any type of ruling on law of the case, issue preclusion, or Article 1, Section 6 of the Nebraska Constitution.
If the case were affirmed, what's your comment, please?
If the case were affirmed, then the third-party complaint brought by Broken Bow Public Schools against Mrs. Christensen would be moot because it's an action for contribution or indemnity and there's no liability.
Thank you.
Are there any other defenses out there that have not been handled by the trial court?
Could you rephrase your question, Your Honor? I'm not sure if I understand.
I'm not sure. I was asking about the procedural process when it was sent back down before. I think we said take care of the other defenses, and we seem to be concentrating on a defense. Are there any other defenses out there that the school district might have?
There are factual defenses. So if you affirmed the district court's order, presumably trial would resume with all three parties. And
you mean if we reverse?
If you reversed, I'm sorry. If you reverse, trial would resume with all three parties, and we'd go back and we'd be on the two defendants' cases. And at that point, the district court judge would first have to make a decision on the school's liability, which could go either way. And if the district judge found that the school was liable, there is this potential third-party indemnity or contribution claim against Mrs. Sherbeck that it's my opinion that there are legal doctrines that prevent that claim that have not been ruled on by the district court. But it's incredibly important to me to try to prevent Mrs. Sherbeck from having to go back into a trial. All right. I have exceeded my time, so thank you, Justices.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal, so that concludes arguments in Christensen versus Broken Bow Public Schools. Council, thank you very much. You are excused, and the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is State versus Galindo. I am recused from this matter, and Justice Frydenberg is recused from this matter. So, Judge Stratman will continue to sit with the court, and Judge Burns, also of the Douglas County District Court, will